3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nations, true owners, caretakers and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders, past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognise their unceded sovereignty.
Because the land to us is the whole thing, right? The land is an ecosystem. It's not real estate.
Blockading is symbolic, but it's also literal, because what you're saying is whatever's being done, it stops here. And it's deadly serious because you're laying your body on the line.
Welcome to Tree Sits, Lock-Ons and Barricades, a series about environmental blockading in Australia, Canada and the US during the 1980s and 1990s. Today's program features two interviews about Canadian blockades during the 1980s. The first was conducted in 2017 with Mary Laronde and concerns the rolling blockades the Temagami Anishinaabe community carried out in order to assert their ownership of territory and opposition to clear felling in northern Ontario. Following upon a long campaign to have their sovereignty recognised in settler law, the issue that brought conflict to a head was the construction of new logging roads designed to open up areas in and around the 72,000 hectare Evelyn Smoothwater Park.
Hi, my name is Mary Laronde, and I'm a Temiagama Anishinaabe, which means people of the deep water. That is my First Nation here in Canada. And we're situated in northeastern Ontario, about 400 miles or so, maybe almost 400 miles directly north of Toronto. And I started working for the Temagami Anishinaabe as a information officer in 1982. And that coincided basically with the court case and all of those things. And during the late 80s, 88, 89 specifically, when we were doing the blockades against the this all-season road going through the heartland of the territory, that was my role, was to basically inform people what was going on. I lived in the town of Temagami, so my job there then too was also to use my house was sort of like one of the staging areas where people would come in from, you know, different parts of the province to come to the blockade and be arrested and whatever they needed to do, show their support. And so that was one of the staging areas where people would come to my house, say, and stay overnight, and then the next day I would take them into the blockade camp, that sort of thing. And also to send out daily updates to media and things like that. So I also had a political role. I was on the executive council for the Temagami Anishinaabe for 6 years during this particular time, in the 80s, from about 84 to 1990, I was a member of the council that we, you know, were the leaders of the initiative, et cetera. The negotiating team, the court action, and as well as the blockades.
So what brought about the first blockade in June 1988?
Well, there wasn't really such an inspiration, as we found ourselves, like, in this really untenable position. We had our backs against the wall. They backed us against the wall, and we had no other recourse. We didn't do that lightly. We didn't talk about it that much. I mean, there were actions in British Columbia to prevent logging of old growth forests out there, Clayoquot Sound, and the whole thing with Haida Gwaii and the Haida were very, very active at that time, as were ours were a number of other people, I think. But we didn't really take any kind of cue, I don't think, I don't recall us taking any cue from anyone that was really engaged at that time, like in terms of doing blockades. But this is what happened, was we had a court case. We had lost at the Supreme Court of Ontario. So we had lost at the Ontario level, its trial, and then we went to the Appeal Court of Ontario to appeal that decision. Meanwhile, they were continuing to build this road. Now, the legal question would not be settled until it went to its final appeal, which was at the Supreme Court of Canada. And we were definitely heading there. We knew that. Meanwhile, they were going ahead building the road. You have to understand that where we are is really the highest point of land in Ontario. So the whole thing about clear-cut logging was something that was only even technically possible in the 60s. And that's when things started to really happen, were clear-cut practices and all these huge machineries. And the ability also to access these, till then, they were inaccessible because of the country is so very rugged. There's lots of water, you know, a lot of wetland areas and a lot of hills and rock cuts and rock bluffs and things. It's a very rugged, rugged country. With the technological advances, like in terms of road building and those kinds of big machinery, they were able to get all that stuff in there. And once they were able to build roads, these all-season roads, that's the other thing, they were all-season roads. They cut so they could cut day and night, year-round, which is what they did, which is what they were doing. Like, we had a lot of lumber companies at in the 60s that were operating night and day. Like, they had, you know, the mills were operating and stuff. And so there were probably about four or five of them that operated both day and night. And that's where they got their logs from, and their pulp too. It was from our land. So, in any event, the problem was that at this point they're trying to push this road from Elk Lake, which is on the very northern boundary of our territory of 4,000 square miles, and they're trying to put that road in from the town of Elk Lake. They were already pushing a road down through there. It was called the Beauty Lake Road or the Liskard Lumber Road. It was named out. And so these roads are subsidized, too, by the Ontario government. And then the Red Squirrel Road, they were pushing it through, and they wanted to meet them up right in the heartland of what was the last of the original old-growth ecosystems. So at one time, the Tomogamy Forest, our forest was like 90%, you know, was pine. It was big, huge pine trees, white pine and red pine, and just magnificent trees, and 300, 400 years old, you know, before they start to break down. It had no road access to it, so it was untouched, and that was the last of the ecosystem. We said, well, these guys are going to punch the government-sponsored roads, building a road in there for logging companies, punching it through, and if they get in there and they actually log the rest of that area, they would have been out of business in 5 years anyway. It only had like a 5-year lifespan for them to go in and take all of those logs of that one little area that was left, and then that would be it. Because once you log, we have a very shallow soil there because it's the Cambrian Shield, it's very, very old, it's bedrock, granite. So it took like 10,000 years since the last ice age for that soil to accumulate on there, for these trees to be growing. And the trees hold the earth onto the rocks, like the actual soil onto the rocks. So when they would clear cut and they would go over these like little rocky outcrops that had big, huge trees on them and cut them right down and clear cut them, and all of that soil would just wash away. So we used to say what they're doing is they're turning our land into a desert. There were some clear cuts that were so large that you just nothing but devastation as far as the eye can see, because the process was this. Clear cut the land, and there would be all these slash piles laying around, all these big piles of limbs, like they limb the trees right there and with these big monster machines. Then they would put them in big slash piles, and then they would burn them. It was called cut and run, slash and burn. And what you were left with then was this really charred, ugly land that looked like a nuclear bomb had gone off. And then what they did was they tried to replant it. And some of them they tried to replant by seeding, aerial seeding. The trees just grew too thick, and I don't know what they've done with them now, but then you would need to go back and thin them out. They discovered that white pine didn't grow in clear cuts. So what they were doing was liquidating white pine, which was the most prevalent tree at one time. They were liquidating the white pine because the white pine only regenerates under shade of other trees. But jack pine will and red pine will. So they were converting white pine stands, white pine forests to red pine or jack pine. And a lot of places they didn't even bother. And so what grows after you have a fire, if you don't plant it, what grows is birch and poplar. So a lot of these magnificent conifer ecosystems were converted to very homogeneous plantations and or into very lesser quality trees. So this is what they were doing to our land, and we were just going like, this is crazy. And because we had the court case, so we may appeal to the court, we asked for an injunction against the construction company that was building the road for the Ministry of Natural Resources, the Ontario Department of Natural Resources. That's who was in charge of building the road for these logging companies. And mind you, they're doing this with taxpayer dollars, right? So anyway, we applied for an injunction, and it wasn't granted. And the reason the injunction wasn't granted was because of a very weird way that Western kind of people look at land. This is what the judge ruled, that the construction of the road could go ahead and that logging could continue because the trees are on the land and the land was about title. And the trees were a renewable resource and trees would grow back. So trees aren't attached to the issue of title, like the ownership of the land itself. So what they were saying to us is, if the Supreme Court finds that you do have Aboriginal title, then, you know, you still have your land. It might be degraded or might be different trees, but you're still going to have your land. It's not a part of the land. Like, that is really crazy thinking. Because the land to us is the whole thing, right? Like the birds and the bees and the soil and the water and the insects and the... I mean, that's what the land is. The land is an ecosystem. It's not just this... It's not real estate. Like, it's not a concrete block in a town or the concrete blocks that your house sits on. It's more than that. And we had a lot of assistance. You know, there were environmental organizations that were doing their own thing and protecting the land. And we had a lot of things in common. But one of the things that they always missed is that the fact that it was our homeland. They wanted it for a wilderness park. We have about 3,000 miles of portages, winter and summer trails, through the Homeland Territory that were our trails. Like, these trails are old. You know, they're thousands of years old. And so it's a canoer's paradise. I mean, there's lakes everywhere. We have so much water. It's old mountains. It's a glacier lake. And Tomogamy is a very deep lake, and it's a very big lake. You know, 270 feet deep. We know that it's our job to make sure that the animals are healthy and that the land is healthy. And all of the knowledge of the land is based on this idea of paying respect and giving thanks to everything. Like, you know, if you take an animal, there is a ceremony for that. There's a ritual for that. And these are the gifts of the Creator. These are the gifts of creation. And when you use any of those things, you give respect. Courts decided that we didn't have Aboriginal title by some means that they made up again, legal magic. So we were supposed to go into treaty, and the federal government was looking for us to be taken into treaty because we were missed at the 1850 Robinson-Huron Treaty. But the province would not give up the land because it was too valuable from a timber point of view. And in 1877 was when we first said, look, we didn't go into treaty with anybody. This is our land, but we want to be in treaty. We want to get some money for the land. We want to have a reserve big enough to support us and so we can carry on our way of life. And the chief was looking for protection. So he saw the treaty as a way of protection for the people and their way of life. By having a reserve, which was 100 square miles, at the south end of Lake Tomogamy there, where there was a Tomogamy River, so it would be open water for fishing in the winter. And it was a good choice. They picked a good spot. And the province wouldn't let the land go. And but the feds went ahead and surveyed it and everything, put some people on the list that they, you know, people were never all there at any one time. And they were at their, you know, hunting grounds or whatever. And so whoever was around got registered. So those people got put on the list and they got on the Robinson-Huron Treaty annuity list and they started getting $4 a year, or $3 at first, and then it got bumped up to $4 or something. So the court, in the end, said that because we had taken that treaty money, because the reserve was surveyed and they intended to take our land, so you don't have Aboriginal title. And that is totally without precedent. They just made it up. Like other court cases, other other actions, legal actions, neither side even refers to it. But that's how they finessed it, and so we still don't have an agreement. We still don't have a land base, except for Bear Island, which is 1 square mile. And how we got that was in 1943 or so, I think it was, the federal government purchased that land from $3,000 from the Ontario government so that we could have a place to live and we wouldn't be persecuted by the Ontario government. Because everywhere we went, they would persecute us for cutting firewood without a permit, hunting without a permit, fishing without a permit. I mean, that's our life. That's how we lived, right? Mm. So they made our way of life illegal. And they persecuted us, and they would take away our guns and our nets, and they would put people in jail. And if you went to jail, sometimes you never came home. The chief at the time, Alec Paul, said to them, this was 1913, and he was recorded by an ethnologist that was in our area there. And he said, he wanted him to write it down. I want you to write this down, he says, you know. He says, we don't need a white man to come and tell us how to treat the animals and how to live and how to treat the land, he says. He says, we know what we're doing. He says, we're not going to ruin the land and kill all the animals. He says, because this is our home. This is where we live. He says, because we can't get on a train like the white man does and just go someplace else after he takes everything from that area, from that spot. We can't do that. This is our home. And every successive chief from 1877 to present day has said the same thing.
You're listening to Tree Sits, Lock-Ons and Barricades on Community Radio 3CR. Today we're listening to Mary Larone discuss two blockades the Temagami Anishinaabe community carried out in 1988 and 1989 to prevent the building of a road through their territory. During the 1988 blockade, the area was occupied for months, and despite legal attempts to remove it, no construction equipment was brought in. In 1989, an environmentalist blockade, mainly involving non-Indigenous activists, using tactics such as tree-sitting and lock-ons, ran during September and October. By the end of October, the Temagami Anishinaabe directed this blockade to end and began a new one of their own. Listeners should note that in Ontario and BC at this time, the practice of authorities was generally not to use criminal law to immediately remove Indigenous blockaders in remote areas. Instead, the police generally requested that the companies being blockaded apply for court injunctions. Once granted, these would result in police formally warning blockaders that they were breaking an injunction. They would then be asked to confirm that the group would not move before they were arrested. Where we pick up the conversation with Mary Larone, she discusses daily events of 1988 and 1989, as well as the effect of legal cautions that had been placed on the land in the 1970s to prevent the majority of development outside of logging.
So we lost the injunction, and we really didn't talk about it very much, except for the fact that, well, there's nothing we can do. The only thing we can do now is physically stop them. We had no other recourse but peaceful action. And it was a very peaceful action. We had meetings with the police. We told the police what we were doing. We had meetings with them every day. They arrested everybody every day that we were out there just about. You know, they were clearing people off the land and ours. So they would arrest us, and then the machinery would move forward again and do some more road cutting. Then we would go to that spot. So our base camp was at the north end of Lake Temagami on Wanapate, which is a youth camp that the owners gave us access to use as our base camp. So out on the road there, everybody would show up every morning just before the contractors showed up, the road construction guys showed up, and the police showed up, and then they would just take people off the road, and we would hold them up for, you know, several hours, a few hours, till everybody got processed, and they had to do everything by the book, read you your rights and all that sort of stuff. And one of the times that we did, though, manage to hold the company up for a whole day, we had busloads of people come down from northwestern Ontario, and they're Ojibwe-speaking people with a large Cree influence, and they lived in very small, sort of remote communities, very difficult to get out, only had winter roads. In the summertime, you'd have to fly out. And a lot of these people came down, two busloads of people came down from up there, Big Trout Lake and Muskrat Dam, with all these older people sitting on the roads. Some of them do not speak English. They speak Ojibwe or Ojibwe, Anishinaabemowin. So anyway, they had to be dealt with in their language, and they had a hell of a time finding somebody that would translate for them. So That's how we kept them. That's how we managed to stop them from one whole day. That was one of the a number of better days on the road. And at that particular blockade was the last one. It was November to December. In 30 days, there were 218 arrests. We didn't do any barricades. We weren't at all militant. We did not want to interfere with anyone's property. The rules of engagement were: don't touch the machinery, stay away from the machinery. When we went to do our blockade, we sent an eviction notice to the Tuolumne Wilderness Society, like the big environmental organization that was up there doing their thing. We evicted them. We evicted Carmen Construction, and we evicted the M&R. Now, with the environmentalists, we had to evict them too, you see, because we were taken over, and they were the only ones that did leave. But so that's what we did, like sort of to clear things out when we had our blockades. We had a meeting every morning with the police, with the commander, and there was communications between he and Gary and our second chief, Rito Sullivan. Every morning there was a briefing, and at the end of the day there was a debriefing. And you know, and when they touched blades, when they basically touched blades, we called it, like to complete the road, when we dismantled the blockade, we had a big ceremony there to take down the camp and end the whole thing. And the Ontario Provincial Police were in our ceremony. They came and they smudged with us, and so the relationship was really good. But we had started another blockade in 1988 at Sharp Rock, which was where the road wasn't even there yet. The road was there, but it needed to be upgraded. Mm-hmm. It was an old logging road there already. And what they were trying to do was push it through from Sharp Rock Inlet, which is the very northern part of Lake Tuolumne, join it up with that Nuliskid Lumber Road. Anyway, so that particular blockade at Sharp Rock was June to September 1988. There was 95 days. There were no arrests. And at one point, and the road was a gated road. They weren't using that road. It was not in use because they were getting ready to build the extension, the Red Squirrel Road extension. And so at one time, I was talking to one of the men that worked at the Ministry of Natural Resources. And one time, he says to me, "That was quite the coup, you know." He says, "It only dawned on us," he said, "about a month into the blockade, that you guys were blocking a road that nobody was using, and everybody was going crazy. We could have just forgot about it," he says, "because there was nothing was going on, right?" So that was kind of like a real, I just felt like we had just finessed them, so you know, I didn't really think about that either, like, you know. But we had really good media coverage, because we had a really good spokesperson. Our chief, Gary Potts, was a great leader, and an excellent spokesperson, and we had the cautions on the land, too. Like, that legal action started in 1972 when we put cautions on title on 110 townships, 4,000 square miles of land. Mm. And the cautions, it's a legal instrument that stops the land from being registered. So what they call crown land, or land that was assumed by the province as being crown land, and they have and all the benefits of land inures to the province. This is in the Constitution Act of the BNA Act, British North America Act, 1867, where the provinces in Confederation at that time, there were federal things and then there were provincial things, and the provinces got the land and resources under their jurisdiction. And they call it crown land. Unless it has a patent, or you buy the land, or you get, there is a deed. The caution was against all unregistered lands in Indaki Manan, which was most of it. So, because we weren't going after, you know, private property and things like that. And so when the cautions came on, logging could continue, because logging does not require a land patent, a registration of title on that property or on that piece of land. What it requires is a land use permit. So it's crown land that the provincial government is permitting. So we had cautions on the land. So that's when the court case ensued shortly after that. Like, of course, the province tried to get those cautions removed and many times, and they didn't. And so finally they sued us in the Supreme Court of Ontario. So it was actually Ontario versus the Bear Island Foundation. Indians don't have legal status as corporate bodies under Canadian law. So we couldn't do anything under we had no legal instrument to put the to do the claim. So we had to use a charitable organized charitable foundation as our legal instrument to actually be a person in the court of law. The doctrine of discovery is still what the legal foundation of this country is built on. If you take it away, they got nothing.
So what were some of the results of the blockade and the land claims campaign in general?
So it was like it was a last-ditch attempt to protect our homeland and our rights. The road did get built, but the road was never used. I know it's still gated, so it's a closed road. There's not through traffic. I think one of the long-term plans of the province was it for it to be like a transport corridor, like another way of getting, you know, between, you know, and also future things like mining, et cetera. To me, it was a road that was, it wasn't built just for logging. When the logs were done, it was going to be gone. I think it was a road that was built for like a long-term plan for the province to have road access to all the areas of the province at some point. From those blockades, though, the province took notice. So they did make a park out of the Lady Evelyn Smooth Water Lakes. And that part that they wanted to log, that was called the Wakimika Triangle, that's kind of like the area that they were building the road into where all the last old growth was, that is an area they gave to a body called the Wendobin Stewardship Authority as a working model for a treaty of coexistence. So in 1990, we signed a Memorandum of Understanding with the province of Ontario. Well, we removed the blockades. And then the road was held in abeyance. Now the logging was either in the Wilderness Park or it was under the Wendobin Stewardship Authority, which was 50% Temagami Anishinaabe, 50% Ontario at the table. That was the model of coexistence. Co-jurisdiction, so lawmaking authority, and co-management of lands and resources. We started, you know, really documenting a lot of the oral history and a lot of the, and we had historians working for us because we were preparing our case. And people understood, oh my God, this has been going on all this time. They learned their own history. We learned our own history collectively. We went out on the land with the elders to show how they used the land, where their houses were. We did archaeology. I mean, all of these things filled us up with a lot of pride, you know, and the good fight. And we knew that we got a bad shake. I mean, people lived it. They knew that they were treated badly, that we were discriminated against, and that we were brutalized and oppressed and all of that. They knew that. But now it was all becoming really clear, and the elders were so involved. And so all of these things started becoming really very real to people. And they learned their history, and there was a real sense of belonging up to the land and together. And we knew so much more now about one another's grandparents and where they lived and what they did. But at that time, there was a generation of kids that were like preteens and teens at the time, and they called themselves, well, we're land claim babies.
1, 2, 3, 4. First you have to have a problem. That part isn't hard. The second step is everybody realizing they're like you. They're holding the same card. Step three is finding there's a tactic when everyone believes it could be true. That if all the people work collectively, there just might be something we can do and everything can change. Businessmen and TV sets will try hard to make sure it isn't so. You don't have a problem. If you do, it's not the same problem. And if it is, well, there's just nowhere you can go. But that many times, the history is rich, though we easily forget how a meme can take hold and grab you, how it can spread out like a net, and everything can change. They'll say we are lost or we're dreaming, or they'll make a dream for us. They'll try to come up with a good story, about why we belong at the back of the bus, about why we belong in this position, about how we don't know what we meant, about how there most certainly isn't any such thing as the 99%, but everything can change so quick. Everything can change so quick.
You're listening to Community Radio 3CR, and the track you just heard was Everything Can Change by David Rovix. Today's program is Tresits, Lock-Ons and Blockades, and our second interview is with Terry Glavin, who discusses the wave of blockades that occurred in British Columbia during the 1980s. Despite a series of court decisions recognising native title in the Canadian province, its government refused to negotiate treaties, with the result that many First Nations began to assert sovereignty directly by blockading the logging companies, developers and others who were seeking to exploit their lands and fisheries. Following direct action over issues such as fishing rights, First Nations in British Columbia first halted the movement of loggers at Mears Island in Clayoquot Sound in 1984. This was followed by a concerted anti-logging campaign involving more than 70 arrests by the Haida Nation at Lyell Island during 1985 and 1986. Further direct action against development at Saanich Town Bay occurred in 1985, and more anti-logging blockades were held at Wasulis in 1986. Several blockades followed thereafter in the Chilcotin and other territories well into the 1990s. The clear felling of forests was often a major point of contention, and one which brought First Nations in areas such as Clayoquot Sound and Haida Gwaii into alliances with local non-Indigenous residents. Blockading tactics varied widely, from sitting in the road and submitting to arrest, through to building barricades and erecting checkpoints, but property damage and physical violence rarely occurred. Terry Glavin worked for a variety of newspapers in the 1970s and 80s before becoming a journalist for the Vancouver Sun, where he covered a number of issues related to native title and the environment. He has also written for and about the Chilcotin and Kitsan peoples, including his 1990 book, A Death Feast in Dim La Hamid.
So, I mean, I was already quite familiar with the overall issues behind in the struggle for the recognition of Aboriginal title. How it came to pass that I ended up writing a book about the Gixxan is Wee Sates, otherwise known as Ralph Michel. He phoned me up one day and he said, you know, who's that writer, that fellow Michener, he says to me. And so I said, okay, Wee Sates, yeah, where's this going? And he says, well, we want you to be our Michener. You should come up and hang out with us, and because things are going to get weird in the next year or two. And I said, let me think about it. And I said, what, you know, and then I, sort of as time went by, you know, I started looking through my notebooks, and I started to see a book emerging. And then, you know, I said, okay, I'm writing a book, I guess.
So can you tell us about the background to the native title struggles that were happening in the 70s and 80s?
In British Columbia, we just didn't talk. Wasn't sort of permitted to, you know, really talk much about the fact that this huge landmass that's larger than Oregon, California, and Washington State combined wasn't really part of Canada exactly. I mean, it was, but it wasn't. It was crown title, but there was, you know, this Aboriginal title hadn't been extinguished. You know, all of this land that had been given away or preempted in the early days, and the forest licenses, the mining leases, the water rights, the cattle grazing rights, and so on, had been essentially portioned out unlawfully. And, you know, in the very early days, of course, there was a concerted attempt at the suppression of, you know, how it came to pass that British Columbia entered Confederation in 1871. We basically joined Canada on a lie. We convinced the federal negotiators that there was no Indian title to extinguish. Yeah, Royal Proclamation of 1763 didn't extend over the Rocky Mountains. It extended up the watershed of the Missouri and the Mississippi and the Arctic watershed, perhaps, but it didn't extend into the Pacific watershed. And, you know, you had people at the time who were real scoundrels. I mean, you know, people like Amor de Cosmos, who would say, well, yes, you know, the Indians, they have no more right to the land than the he-panther or the she-bear. Mm. And it was obvious we had not complied with the law that we, the British and Canadian constitutional custom of acquiring the Aboriginal title or surrender of the Aboriginal title prior to settlement had not occurred over the vast landscape of mainland British Columbia. Only southern Vancouver Island was treatied. And basically the rest of the province was being unlawfully occupied by all kinds of people.
So can you tell us about some of the things that were happening in British Columbia at that time regarding native title and what happened in the 1970s and 80s to bring about resistance to clear felling?
So, yeah, it was a very exciting time, and there were various court cases that started to pile up. There was the Sparrow decision, the Garin decision, the Nishka decision. Things were starting to come to a head, so... And it was also at a time when the logging companies were pushing deeper into Indian country. Logging practices were becoming untenable. You know, massive, just vast clear cuts. And, the industry was giving every impression of basically, let's get it while the getting's good and get the hell out of here, you know? Mm-hmm. Which I think is basically what they did, the majors. And so a lot of the tribes were looking at their resource wealth being carted off in logging trucks and said, you know, I think that's about enough of that. San and the Wet'suwet'en were leaders in that. They were very tough. This was a very concerted effort to protect the resources of the traditional territories of the hereditary chiefs. The argument was not that, you know, we're angry, so we're trespassing, or, you know, we have a right to trespass or something. It was, you guys are trespassing. The logging companies are trespassers. The mining companies are trespassers. The Cattlemen's Association is a trespasser. Come and get me. You know, you want to go to court? You want to bust me? Let's have you then. This was militant direct action to protect their territories. You know, there was a time, it didn't last very long, I think it was Oka Summer, actually. For a period of time there, it was the lower mainland of British Columbia, Vancouver, basically cut off from the rest of the province by road or rail. And, one roadblock led to another block, which inspired another roadblock. There was an interesting kind of confluence between what might be described as the objectives of the environmental movement and the objectives of the First Nations leadership. There was a lot of really interesting sort of synchronicity there. But I think the thing to remember about this thing that we call the environmental movement is that it was really an expression of a significant body of public opinion. And there came a point, I remember a public opinion poll when I was working at the Vancouver Sun, that the vast majority of British Columbians believed the Aboriginal leadership on the question of Aboriginal title and did not believe the white politicians on the subject. It was a really interesting moment in history where what to an outsider might not unreasonably be apprehended as really saucy, militant Aboriginal direct action actually had a significant amount of a cross-section of public sympathy in fishing rights struggles, in the land rights struggles. What the people that they were up against, the Employers Council of BC, the Chamber of Commerce, the Fisheries Council of BC, and so the people that you're up against, what is the sort of corporate interest? And they show up in all of the fishing rights cases, all of the blockade cases, the land rights cases, all of the major resource development corporations. You had attorneys general under the social credit government who were still cleaving to the old line from the lie. The, you know, the lie from the period of Confederation negotiations, that there's no such thing as Aboriginal title, and if there ever was a thing as Aboriginal title, it was extinguished long ago, and there's nothing to talk about. And they didn't necessarily have the backing of workers, by the way.
From 1988 onwards, Gitxsan Wet'suwet'en communities mounted an increasing number of blockades. These eventually reached the point where the logging companies were forced to cut out the provincial government and negotiate directly with the First Nation leadership. You later wrote a book that covered much of this period. What are some of your memories of it?
In Gitxsan country, the Gitxsan represent about 50-60% of the population of the territory. The sort of nucleus, because it's an ancient sort of center of the universe, is basically the confluence of the Bulkley and the Skeena Rivers in what is now what's known as the Hazeltons. Old Hazelton, New Hazelton, and South Hazelton. And the mayor of Old Town, the mayor of Hazelton, Alice Maitland, white lady, totally supported the chiefs in what they were trying to do. Totally supported the blockades. They'd show up, you know, and they'd bring tea to the guys, and, you know, they'd talk about hockey. And, you know, it was, you know, people were trying, in that part of the world, whether they, you know, a lot of the white people were trying to keep the wealth of the resource within the territory. They didn't want to just see these state-of-the-art sawmills that employed nobody, or maybe even no sawmills at all, and, you know, logging trucks just taking everything away. Yeah, they didn't need a lot of outside people. I mean, some of those events were pretty huge, 200-300 people who would show up for the main event on the first day or something like that. But they were locals, right? They were all Gitxsan.
In a lot of cases, the blockade seemed to have been a way to force the issue back into the courts and to get the courts to once again discuss the core issue of sovereignty and title.
Yeah, I mean, the tribes were increasingly interested in getting it into the courts. And there was always, you know, a kind of a three steps forward, two steps back on the scope and the extent of title. You know, although the courts have been so sensible about it and so, you know, really serious about this, they don't have extinguishment of any title. They don't have specific recognized forms of title that apply to tracts of land, but they have enough, you know, logical inferences to be drawn from the law that has evolved that nobody's going to mess with these guys.
So can you comment on some of the specific blockades and the alliances that came about during them?
In the early goings, one of the things that was really noticeable in the, you know, the forest blockades throughout the Chilcotin country and the Lillooet country, Wet'suwet'en, Gitxsan, on the coast, definitely on, my gosh, on the west coast of Vancouver Island, you know, Clackwood Sound to Fino, and definitely in Haida Gwaii, you had local people who'd lived there for a while and were white people, but they were really connected. You know, this was sort of part of the sort of Penturbia phenomenon that was sort of a second wind to the back to the land movement in the 60s. Like, you know, all of the people in the countryside were really sophisticated. And so you get these really interesting people, geographers. This is something that was really interesting. It's people with, you know, who were into GPS mapping and stuff, and people who were totally wired in, who were working for tribal councils or were contracted to the tribal council from time to time. And you know, their kids went to the same schools, and they wore the same Mackinac jackets, and they went fishing in the same places, this kind of stuff. And that was really nice. I mean, that was something that was really a great thing to watch, is that, you know, the outward impression that could be given, if you're a journalist, is that, you know, you have whites versus Indians. But it was so rarely like that. Sometimes it was, and then you were thinking, oh my God, you know, these people, they're saying all these really mean things to one another right now. So what do? Do you write down what they're saying, and then it's in print, and it's on the front page of the Vancouver Sun, and they'll resent this for the rest of their lives, and you'll have this sort of, you know, Hatfield-McCoy stuff going on. So, you know, you had to be really careful about the way you covered this stuff. You had to be very thoughtful and generous and decent. But the networking, you know, in the case of Mears and the Clackwood, you know, the Clackwood Biosphere Reserve was established. In the case of South Moresby, the Gwaii Hanas Park Reserve was established. So the hippies got what they wanted, you know, the environmentalists, and the tribes got what they wanted, and so everything was great. That doesn't always work, though. Mm. You know, in the Kitlope in the north, the Kitlope was a good case of that working. So, you know, you've got that kind of synchronicity of interest between various environmental networks and various sections of the tribal leadership. Back in the 80s, it was really, really, really gumboot stuff. It was grassroots stuff. That field of struggle, fishing rights, is, you know, it's just a match made in heaven between the tribal leadership and the environmental movement. Sometimes it's not that easy in forestry, right? A lot of Aboriginal people, they just want to be loggers. But when environmentalists start talking about habitat protection, you know, that's it. I mean, we're on the same side. We're friends.
And can you comment on how different First Nations were working together at this time?
People were really working solidly together on the land question. And, you know, the lawyers, the legal teams were often the same. And so, you know, you had this sort of complex strategy of direct action on the ground, political mobilization, sort of advocacy work at everything from the municipal level to the regional district level. You had the federal work and the First Nations stuff in Ottawa, and then you'd have, you know, these various fronts that were being opened up in law, which was the whole point of the thing, and the lawyers were often the same people, right? There would be connections between different law firms, and they would talk strategy.
And what were some of the differences between the different campaigns and the outcomes that they managed to achieve?
The main thing in the case of the New Channels and Clackwood Sound was to protect Clackwood Sound. No more clear-cutting, no logging, you've come this far, that's it, go away. And similarly, Haida Gwaii was much the same, except in Haida Gwaii, it was a far greater emphasis on questions of Haida title and sovereignty. In the case of the Gitxsan, it was more specifically about resource control and to get control of that. The way Gordy Sebastian would describe it, any old little old Indian can put up a roadblock. It scares the shit out of these guys. You show up on the Susquehanna, you know, the dirt road going up into the Babeen, you know, at 6 o'clock in the morning, one little Indian. You can stand there, you know, and put a little log across the road and say, okay, you can't come. And the trucks stop and everybody freaks out, oh, crap, you know, we got a land title issue here, call the cops, call the boss, what do we do? Anybody can do that. The trick is taking the roadblock down. That's the hard part, figuring out, okay, who gets in? How much are they allowed to take? Whose house territories are they permitted to log within? What are the benefit sharing arrangements that they're prepared to negotiate? That's the difficult stuff. What the Gitxsan were going after was title. So that's a totally different thing, right? That's the really high stakes fight. Mm. And that's the one that went all the way to the Supreme Court of Canada and resulted in Delgamuukw versus the Queen. In the Chilcotin case, it was similar. You know, they'd have these little mini wars, you know, like battles for over various watersheds. Various logging companies would piss them off, and, you know, and they'd put up roadblocks and stop them from coming in for a while, and there'd be injunctive relief, and things would get weird. In the case of the Namaya, the Far Chilcotins, there wasn't a road in until 1973, and the military punched it. The army did it. So what they were wanting to do is protect their trap lines. It was basically a trap line case. They wanted to protect their valley. They wanted to protect their mountains. And they had environmental groups supporting them in that. You know, the environmental movement in the city, you know, in Vancouver and Victoria and so on, would kind of act as the advocates for the Namaya in their legal case. Each roadblock campaign, if we can put it that way, they each had their own unique characteristics, and they're also the sort of ground that they made in law was unique. The Chilcotin question that was just recently decided, like in the last couple of years, was about Aboriginal title and about consent and about the legitimacy of forest licenses, on a specific area of land. It elaborated on the Delgamuukw decision, the Gixan finding, which was huge, right? In Haida Gwaii, some of the legal ground that was established was about the duty to consult, you know, who's involved in decision-making. But they basically won their battle by the establishment of the park reserve. Mm. And in Clackwit, it was kind of a mix, right? It was kind of an environmental victory, a political victory, and, you know, some legal victory as well in terms of, you know, what does Aboriginal title mean and what the obligations of the Crown are. And there was all kinds of interesting conversations that were going on at that time about, you know, what would life after land claims look like? How do white people fit into the landscape? How do we sort this stuff out? But, you know, right now, the whole situation is just sort of in suspended animation because of the treaty process.
You've just been listening to an interview with Canadian writer Terry Glavin, discussing some of the many blockades that occurred in British Columbia during the 1980s in order to assert First Nations sovereignty and prevent the clear felling of old-growth forests. My name's Ian McIntyre, and I hope you join me again next Saturday from 11 to 12 for more of Tree Sits, Lock-Ons and Barricades, a summer series concerning environmental blockading during the 1980s and 1990s, here on Community Radio 3CR.